Hey, church leaders, welcome to the Slingshot Group podcast. I'm your host, Tim Foote, CEO of Slingshot Group, where we build remarkable teams and healthy culture through staffing and coaching. And for today's conversation, I'm joined by Dr. Kevin Brown, the president of Asbury University. Most of you know about the outpouring that happened at Asbury back in February. For those that might be listening to this in the future, February 2023, unbelievable what happened during that month. And so today we get to talk about it. And that's enough intro. Let's jump into the conversation. Dr. Kevin Brown, it is great to have you on the Slingshot Group podcast today. I have so many questions for you, but first and foremost, I'd love to get a brief context on your story and background and your journey to becoming the president at Asbury University in Wilmore, Kentucky.
Thanks, Tim. And it is great to join you. I really appreciate the opportunity. Yeah, I grew up in a family of educators, and then I went into banking. And so, but had a good experience. But in 2009, I transitioned from banking into Christian higher education. I was teaching at Anderson University, and I started teaching here at Asbury in 2013. I taught in our School of Business. I taught the stuff students tend to roll their eyes at, or worse, economics and statistics. But I really enjoyed those subjects. And in 2019, I learned that my name had been thrown in the hat for the presidency. And my wife and I gave prayerful consideration to moving forward. And we did. And doors kept opening. And July 1st of that year, I started. So in less than a month, I'll be entering into my fifth year of the presidency.
Wow. And I bet it's been an amazing 4 into 5 years of leadership experience. So I'm just going to jump right in, Kevin, if that's okay. Lots of our listeners know the story. Maybe some are coming in cold, but I doubt it. But obviously on February 8th in the small town of Wilmore, Kentucky, it seemed like just another ordinary day at Asbury University, right? And yet, what started on that day led to an extraordinary move of God that spread all over the world. And so many of us got to see what was happening from afar. You got to see it all happening right in front of you. And you had to lead a team and a whole university through this. If you wouldn't mind, can you take us back to that day and the weeks that followed and share with us what happened?
You know, shortly after that, I had a meeting with a group of presidents, and they asked about it. And this is my disclaimer. I told them that my comments might be disappointingly inarticulate because there's a lot that I'm still trying to process myself. And then even the words that we give to these extraordinary events, is it the right word? Is it the right expression? Does the word itself limit the fullness of what took place? So I just say all that as a disclaimer. But you're right, February 8th, Asbury has regularly scheduled chapel. It's mandatory for our student body, and it's strongly encouraged for our staff and faculty community. And this was a Wednesday. My wife was in chapel. I actually streamed it from my office. And yes, it was a very ordinary chapel. The speaker was familiar to our community. He does a great job. Some people may have heard he had been out of town and arrived back in town the night before at 4 a.m. So it's not like he even had a full night of rest. And then we had our gospel choir, which they're amazing, and they sing. And on my stream, it just phases out. It's like, okay, you're done.
Right.
And then I had a meeting, and I was actually scheduled to go out of town the next morning for a week. And so I was going to have lunch with my wife, and I finished up my meeting, and she had texted me and said, hey, I'm still in chapel. Students stayed and they prayed and they're worshiping and they're talking. So I'm still here. I'm not going to come home for lunch. And so I stopped in, I spent some time there. then I did go eat lunch. I came back and students were still there, and it was one of those, all right, I might cancel my next meeting because this is kind of cool. And then some folks came up and encouraged me to send an email to the community. And so I went to my office and just sent an email out. Hey, it is a wonderful thing when people stay and pray in chapel, and you are invited to come and do the same. And again, I didn't want to confer some title or label onto what was happening, just to say, here are the things people are engaged in, and that's a great thing. Please come. I would say it was that late afternoon that there was a sense of like something special is happening, something beyond just some folks sticking around. Early evening, another minister who had come to provide assistance came back to me and just said, hey, Kevin, I really think you should consider leaving the chapel open all night. Because to me, I always just thought the next hour, everyone will leave.
Right.
And then the next hour, I didn't want them to necessarily. I just assumed. And so a group of us met in the basement below Hughes Auditorium about keeping things open all night and who would take different shifts. And then the next day it continued and it was a little bigger. And Friday it was bigger. And this began to spread. And by the time the weekend came, just droves of visitors came in. And I believe it was Saturday night, there wasn't a seat, an unoccupied seat in the building, and people were standing. And so from there, it just hit an inflection point and absolutely took off.
On that first day, when you said we started to sense something was happening, tell me a little bit more about what you were sensing. And then I'm fascinated to know when you decided to cancel your trip next day. Because I'm a planner, and I'm sure all of our lives have been turned upside down since COVID, of course. But I'm a planner. Yes. How did that all play out?
As far as there is something about seeing men and women, seeing college students humble themselves and really seek the face of the Lord and really take on a posture of humility, whether that's at an altar. There was just a hunger. There was really some raw confession. And you just see students together. There was a kind of abandonment of our regular routines. So there's this sense of like, this is out of the ordinary, but there's no direction. It's administrators aren't standing up and saying, now do this, or you don't have to go to your classes, or we would encourage you to huddle together in groups, or please come to the altar. It's just expressions that students were taking on, and the staff, the faculty, administration were kind of staying out of the way and just observing and praying and thanking the Lord. As far as planning, I think I canceled the next day. I think at that point, the person I was supposed to be traveling with, who was in Florida, I'll come this weekend. And then the next day I said, I'll be there on Monday. And then that weekend, like, I ain't coming. So that was how that played out, that as this continued on, I just felt I really have a responsibility to be present. Again, not to do something or facilitate something, but just to be present as someone who works at the school. Not a lot of thinking went into canceling the trip because it just seemed so obvious to me at the time.
It's interesting, and I want to dig into this a little bit later, but you talked about I just needed to be present, not to necessarily lead or do anything, but as somebody who works here at the school, that takes a certain type of leadership when you're the president. And I want to put a comma in that and come back to it. But you talked about how this grew, Kevin, and I know whether my stats are right, but 15,000 people visiting each day, 50,000 to 70,000 visitors visiting Wilmore, representing 200 plus academic institutions, multiple countries. Now, I know there's been a unique history of revivals, outpourings at Asbury, including one in 1970 that had a massive mm-hmm. cultural impact. When you became president of Asbury back in 19, did you do some leading through revival training? Like, I'm tongue in cheek. We've got somebody with a banking background, obviously a remarkable leader. The impact of what happened here is immeasurable. Was it incredibly surprising to you? Does it connect back to the history of Asbury? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I did that training right after the COVID-19, how to handle a global pandemic training.
Oh, yeah, that training, the one that we've all done.
That manual you pull off the shelf. You know, here's what I will say about our community. You're right. There's no training. There's no playbook. But there is an imagination for it in our community because we've had this happen throughout time. 1970, but there have been other revival-like experiences. Oddly, they've happened in February, most of them, if not all of them. So I think there is... It's in the water in our community. There's a kind of collective imagination about what's happening and a collective desire to foster that and let it unfold. But as far as what was unfolding before us, no one said, this is a revival. This is a renewal. It's just, this is a mass expression. Matthew 5:6, blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, they will be filled. I saw our students in our own community, people in the region. You mentioned other colleges and universities. We counted 284. And then from other countries, hungry. They were hungering and thirsting after righteousness. And they left the dinner table satisfied. Wow. And so there was an imagination for that. And thus a deep desire to say, Lord, what you are desiring to do and people who are coming to seek the Lord, how do we create room at the table for that to take place? There wasn't someone standing up in front of the community, the microphone, and say, okay, here's how we're going to do this. It's just amazing men and women in this community who all share that imagination and were selfless in a way to, at their own expense, create the conditions for that to unfold. I would say that's the highlight of my professional experience, is just the blessing to be a part of that with a large group of people was incredible.
Yeah, we were talking before we started recording, Kevin, about how you're still getting your head around this and still processing this. And I guess it really is immeasurable, the impact that this has had. And there have been revivals, outpourings, moves of God, whatever we want to call it. This, from what I've observed, has been the first move of God like this in the social media era. So we can measure, we know that there were over 63 million views on TikTok of the hashtag Asbury Revival. With all the attention on Asbury, there was naturally a lot of opinions on every decision that was made. Now, we're students of leadership at Slingshot Group. We're students of team and the dynamics of leading teams. We've got church leaders leading teams and teams of volunteers watching or listening. With all the attention on Asbury and all the opinions, I can't imagine the pressure on you and the pressure the team must have been feeling. What was your approach to leading through criticism? Did you have any guiding principles or values that filtered how you made decisions?
As it relates to criticism, I think proximity plays a really important role. And if there is a critique, its legitimacy, in my opinion, rises and falls proportionate to the proximity that person has to the event. So if students had some concerns, I'm all ears. If a student's parents have some concerns, I'm all ears. If someone in Montana who thinks I'm squelching the spirit or something like that, that is just not going to hold the same weight to me as what's happening right within our community. As far as priorities, prioritization, and I want to be careful how I say this. I think what happened in February is a kind of fruit of our mission, but it's not our mission. Now, it's not to say there isn't a deep appreciation for it, a deep desire to make room at the table, as I said earlier, but we are a student-centric university that exists for the formative spiritual, social, intellectual, and moral development of 18 to 22-year-olds or any students that join us regardless of their age. That's why we exist. That's why we get up in the morning. And so at some point, we need to consider the importance of who do we wake up to serve and how do we continue to serve that group. And I'll just share, if you don't mind,
please.
The second week, so after a lot of folks were coming, I think there was a really critical meeting. And the more distance I have between what happened and where I am now, the more I see the importance of that meeting. So these were our presidential cabinet, the executive cabinet of the school, associate vice presidents, the deans, our academic deans, our student body president was available, our directors, so like the director of our physical plant, security, information technology. So probably 20 or so people in the room. And I just said, look, what's happening is historic. And I think that this is something really special. It's unfolding in a way that we'll talk about and narrate this for centuries. It will, or not centuries, decades. It will outlast us. And I was kind of, I don't know, rambling on. And someone in the group just said, what are you asking? And I said, I guess I'm just asking, are you with me? Will we accommodate this? And it was a really beautiful moment. Every person in the room just said, we're with you. This is worth it. Now, they said, we need a horizon. We can't do this indefinitely. And our number one responsibility is to our students. And I would say, it's technical language, but as an administrator, I have a fiduciary responsibility to the resources and mission of the school, which is student-centric in its orientation as commissioned by our Board of Trustees.
Right.
And so our board doesn't say, you have a goal to facilitate revival-like events, and our academic accrediting body does not hold us accountable to that. The school always kept an eye on the mission. And to relate to your earlier question, the way I thought about criticism was simply to pay close attention and to listen to the voices that were within the circle of our mission. And if they were outside of that, it's not that it was unimportant, but it was less important than who is right in front of me that I wake up and go to sleep thinking about insofar as achieving our mission to serve.
That's so helpful to hear you say that, Kevin. As we've got lots of church leaders listening, I just want to drill that down, that filter you talked about, proximity, because mm-hmm. you know that like you experienced and probably experience all the time that you lead, church leaders are getting all kinds of opinions and criticism mm-hmm. from folks that are part of their gatherings, part of their community. And often the filter needs to be, how invested is this person in the mission and
yes.
the vision of what we're doing?
Yes.
And to be able to track that and keep the criticism in perspective. Also, the way that you focused on who you serve and the mission and vision associated with that. But also, I want to point out the power of that question you asked your team. Because so often leaders will lead directively And we've always believed in the power of question, and you putting the choice back in the hands of your team members. Are you with me? I mean, that is so important and so powerful in this situation. How do you feel the leadership team that you led manage with both open-handedness, but also trying to not let things get out of control, but knowing that things weren't even in control? How did you balance that?
Great question. And when I say leadership team, I should probably make a distinction between two different groups that I found myself a part of. One was the leadership team of the institution. These are the men and women I work most closely with, the VPs, the staff and faculty were involved. That was extraordinary. I mean, to say it's extraordinary is just an incredible understatement. It was the greatest act of collective hospitality I've ever seen in my life. I just have so many stories of, you know, a faculty member would teach a class and then would go and usher or bring ice or change toilet paper or the garbage. It was amazing. And there wasn't an incentive program to do that, or there wasn't a mandate. It was just men and women who wanted to serve. That was just in their DNA. As it related to our classes, our provost very wisely, I think, just put that in the hands of the faculty and said, I trust you and I trust your discernment. So that was one, I guess, leadership team. The other was the kind of on the ground. As I said, that very first night when we were in the basement and trying to discern, that was comprised of some Asbury folks and then some other folks who were ministry friends of the university. And we literally met in the basement. Days later, we were meeting in what effectively was like a broom closet, like a custodial closet. And we would plan 2 or 3 hours out, and then we'd go back to our little closet. And not even everyone could stand up or sit down at the same time. It was that small. But then, how's everyone doing? What are you sensing? What needs to happen next? What concerns are there? And just constantly checking in. One person referred to it as observe and respond posture. And so that, and then a kind of command room got established. A classroom was occupied, and there were just all these like flow charts on the wall. And so that leadership team, it was just constantly checking in with one another, but also having a kind of maturity to discern what was happening and how we responded to it at a given time. And there was a lot of discussion. And one person said at the beginning of that, we need to just have an unoffendable spirit. So if we challenge each other, if we interrupt each other, if there's some frustration, let's just be unoffendable. And it was amazing how that group reacted to each other and responded to deal with what was a really, really stressful. I mean, our bodies received that like a kind of trauma, to be honest. You know, I would get home at 1 or a.m. in the morning, and I would eat a bowl of cereal and just try to calm my brain down. My body was so tired, but I just could not shut down this freight train that was going through my mind. So those were the two kind of leadership groups I found myself working within.
I can't imagine, Kevin, the adrenaline for you and those that were doing logistics. And when you talk about this sense of, or the fact that you saw the greatest act of hospitality that you've ever seen, it makes me think, and the closet that you were having to do a lot of the reacting in, it makes me think of what God does through the underground church in oppressed nations, and how there's incredible outpourings in these situations. Makes me think of the early church, and the hospitality part of it isn't, they sold everything they had. It's not something you think of until you're experiencing a move of the Spirit that is totally out of control, and you yes. just need to respond to it. There's story after story, I'm sure you're hearing, but all of us are hearing, of people who have been deeply impacted and forever changed by what happened through this outpouring at Asbury. And I can remember, Kevin, personally, I'm a runner. It's my health and sanity. I'll go on early morning runs and just praying for what was happening at Asbury, and then continuing to pray, as I always do, for mm-hmm. revival in my community and outpouring in the community where I live and the church that I'm a part of and through the work that we do. And I remember on a run, one of those mornings when all this was going on, I sensed God saying to me, "Yeah, but are you too busy for revival? Mm-hmm. Are you too busy for it?" And so it makes me want to ask you, how did this affect you personally? And what's different about you because of this? And how did this experience impact you when you go in with so many things on your plate and talking to other leaders who maybe God's challenging them? You pray for revival, but are you interruptible?
With that willingness to be interrupted, just what was happening was so breathtakingly, profoundly good that I didn't really think, I don't think any of us thought of much else. You know, I tell you, I mean, I have hundreds of stories, but just one example, I was talking to a pastor recently about COVID and how difficult COVID was, because there are some really strong views about how you handle it, no matter what you do. And I'm not saying one group is right and one is wrong, and I'm not trying to make that declaration here. Just that it was difficult to achieve unity. And I remember during one of the services, during one of the periods of that, we were invited to get not on our knees, to get on our faces. So you have, you know, 1,500 people in a room. I mean, I was just right next to people. You're practically breathing on each other, on your face. And we're invited to pray and go through prayers. And at one point, the person inviting us to pray said, "God, forgive us in the church for creating disunity over COVID, over masks." And there was just this swell in the room. "Oh, God, forgive us. God, forgive us." And you know, there were people in the room that had some strong opinions over here and some strong opinions over there, but there was this unified, "God, forgive us." I will run through a wall for that kind of environment, for that kind of unity. I would sit in that forever. And so I guess in that sense, in those kinds of moments, I didn't think, "Boy, I'm tired," or "Boy, I'm going to have so much work to do that I'm putting off." It was just, how do I stay present in this and continue to let it unfold in its most healthy expression, but also in a sustainable way for the university? I think that's just where my mind was, and others as well, the whole time.
That feels, Kevin, that kind of unity and that atmosphere yep. feels like His kingdom come on earth.
Yes.
And it yes. feels like you are touching that, sensing that, feeling that. You've referenced a few powerful moments and stories you've encountered. Years from now, as you think back to this outpouring, what are some other stories or moments that stand out to you that speak to the impact of what God did?
Oh, boy. You know, I love college students. When I was a college student, I had women and I had men who just really deliberately poured into my life when they didn't have to, and it changed everything. It just changed the trajectory. And so it's a really, I mean, every part of a person's life as they're growing up is important, every age, grade level. But there's just something special about that college student age where, you know, you're not a kid, you're not a teen, you're a young adult, but there's still a social and emotional and spiritual, intellectual, moral vulnerability. that you're malleable in ways that you may not otherwise be. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just very committed to that group. And I, Tim, just feel a burden for this generation. And so much of what has been placed upon them, it's always difficult to be young and to grow up. How difficult it is to be a young adult in 2023. And so our prayer team that was working with a lot of Gen Z, there were really four things that dominated those prayers. In fact, maybe only four: anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation, and addiction. To hear these stories, to hear these testimonies, to hear people and see people come and lay that at an altar, and then to testify to a freedom, oh my word, that just breaks me apart. One person said, and I'll never forget this quote, he said, if we had the spiritual eyes to see it, that altar would be filled with loosened chains. And the final night, my wife and I were up in the balcony, and this was the College Day of Prayer night, which, by the way, is amazing that date for the College Day of Prayer to be on Asbury's campus happened to be on February 23rd. Wow. And I asked the group when they came in, I said, I've got to know, when did this get scheduled? And he said, 2021. Oh, so pretty incredible timing. And the Jesus Revolution movie came out Friday the 24th. And yeah, just amazing. But so this evening was dedicated solely to Gen Z and college students, and college students were watching all over the country. But I'll never forget, I was in the balcony, and the person speaking was talking to that group, but then they just said, almost as a declaration, you will not be the generation defined by depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, and addiction. And again, just this swell from the audience. I will never, ever, ever forget that. But I'll tell you, the first 3 days were primarily our students. And there were some students who shared and students who responded to each other. That was just really, really powerful and really sweet to me, and things I'll just hold deep in my heart for the rest of my life. Just really special.
Well, and Kevin, for those that are watching this as well as listening, they can see what I can see, and that's the emotion that's still in your eyes when you talk about the effect on the younger generation. And you and I both know much has been made around the decline of interest in Christianity in the church from students and Gen Z. And yet what happened here at Asbury began with students. And yes, some have referred to this outpouring as the anonymous revival, as you've probably heard. And it'd be so easy for the university to have invited, for you to invite big names speakers, big name speakers, worship artists to step in and take over what was happening. Real easy to do that because they were in the room, right? I mean, they were showing up and they were in the room, but that's not what happened. And it seems like there was a conscious effort to make this about the next generation. How did you keep it about the students?
Those leadership groups I mentioned, there was just a perpetual focus on the students. Students, prioritizing Gen Z. There were even some, so many people are coming that we're crowding out some Gen Z students. Can we make deliberate room for that generation? And I just really appreciated that instinct. And it wasn't one that someone had to convince others. It was just a shared prioritization. The amazing thing to me when you talk about that kind of anonymous, humble, I've described it as an uncoordinated humility. Mm-hmm. Just to give an example, and I'm just boasting about some colleagues, like our advancement department, there was never a discussion about what to do, they just immediately decided, we're not fundraising, shut down fundraising while this is going on. And the gift officers just went, they were ushering, they were helping, but it was like, don't go on the road, don't call people, just go over and help. No one had that discussion. No one said, hey, you should do this. Our strategic marketing department said, no social media. We're not going to draft off of this.
Right.
No one asked them to do that. It was just their instinct. And I just saw so many examples of that. And there was just this desire to maintain the tenor of prioritizing students, but having kind of an analog event. I joked, I love Hughes Auditorium. No one would choose that as a Gen Z venue. I mean, if we're honest, I mean, no one would say, oh, that place, I mean, it's old and it has a wonderful feel to it, but it is not like a slick, high-tech, it's not the place you would choose for something that's going to really wow younger generations. But that seemed to be the entire event. Like there wasn't slick marketing. There wasn't like a project management team. It wasn't this high-tech venue, state-of-the-art. There weren't celebrity speakers. The worship was not done by a professional band. It was just this very vertical. And when I talk about the uncoordinated humility, you know, another example of that, I don't remember once where the worship, the group leading worship was uniformly spread across the stage. Typically, they were all kind of tucked over to the left side of the stage. In other words, like we weren't watching a performance. Not that that normally happens, but again, it's just this instinct to kind of get out of the way, and that was just present. But it wasn't something that was, all right, here's our get out of the way plan, and here's how we're going to implement it. And it was just a sensibility that was present, and people just pressed into it.
Mm. We spend so much time trying to architecture experiences, don't we? And God's ways are not our ways, and He will move when He will move, and He will do what He will do. Is there a lesson here for the church, Kevin? A church that can be often too programmed, maybe?
Perhaps. And please forgive me. I've been reticent to here are five takeaways, or not that that's what you're asking. But I do think a lesson or a reconsideration is just what are people looking for, and what attracts them, and what hooks them and sustains them. And again, I just go back to Matthew 5:6, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, they shall be filled. And there was just a deep and trenchant hunger for something real and authentic. And that's what people experienced, and that's what filled them up. So I think the lesson was, if there is one, the at the end of the day, we don't manufacture these things. I think there are conditions that can help to foster and sustain and allow to unfold. But that's different from, the orchestration of something from nothing.
Kevin, I know there are pastors and leaders listening to this right now who are passionate like you about the next generation. We absolutely have to be, but they may not know how to fight for them, to advocate for them. Talk to the leader based off of what you're learning. How can we as leaders fight for the next generation?
I think this is a generation that, and I'm no like generational expert, it's obviously a generation that really values and prioritizes authenticity. And so one of the things that I think is really important is changing a perspective, trying to really bear witness to someone who's young means it's done through the currency of relationship and really getting into the fabric of their life. I think that's very important. That allows someone, it earns them the right to speak into a life. It funds the currency of their words when they do share. The second is when I spend time with this generation, it's really interesting. They don't respond well to propositional arguments. I'll be 46 later this year. I grew up in, you know, the 80s and 90s. And so I loved the Josh McDowell stuff. Here are six reasons the resurrection happened. Like, I loved it. And you want that person to deliver the logical kill, you know, against their enemy or their debate opponent or whatnot. And I think there's still value to thinking of our faith in that way. And there's a reasonable dimension to how we think about our faith. But that's not where I think a lot of this generation is at. And there's a theologian in the United Kingdom I've referenced often, Alison Milbank, who has talked about imaginative apologetics, that the stories that we tell, the music we compose, the poetry that we write, our symbols, our icons. These, she says, are performances of an argument. We perform our argument. We perform our value. We live it out. We are a walking, talking, living, breathing argument. There's another British evangelist, Gypsy Smith. I share this quote all the time at our campus. People would roll their eyes probably if I said it again, but he says there are five gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and the Christian. And most people, he said, will never read the first four. Do I see my life as a gospel, as an argument for the good news of Jesus Christ? So I think that is something that's really important to this generation. So what I saw a lot of Gen Z respond to was something that they saw was real and genuine. And if you just think of the extraordinary cocktail of difficulties that we've all experienced, but particularly young adults, we've had global wars and we've had economic uncertainty, we've had social unrest, racial injustice, and all of this occurred within the context of a global pandemic. And then we have our phones to allow us to be hyper aware of all of this unsettling phenomenon and to maybe guide us and direct us into these echo chambers. And so all of these things have occurred. And so I think there's just a deep hunger from everyone for give me something real, give me something that I can hang on to. And hold on to and give my life to. And I think that this generation will respond. I really believe there is incredible potential with this group. And I would just encourage leaders when we see young adults and we roll our eyes with cynicism about whoever knows what. And I just remind myself of the people who rolled their eyes at me and saw through the raw material I presented when I was 20, to really see the potential in this generation and to invest in them relationally, but also to be the fifth gospel to them, to model and to show them and to perform and rehearse and live out an alternative story that can capture their imagination and invite them into that story. That would be my humble encouragement to ministers and mature Christians for this young generation, because they will bend the universe in a Godward direction if we invest in them.
Kevin, humble and powerful challenge and advice received. Just to be that fifth gospel for that generation as we pave the way for the future and invest in the church of the future. In closing, I'm sure there are so many things you've learned through this experience. Looking back now, is there a key lesson you've learned about leadership and leading a team that you'll carry with you?
so many. You know, I don't want to be overly philosophical, but your comment about running earlier, I've been reading the French philosopher and Christian Simone Weil.
One of my favorites, Kevin. Attention is the only faculty of the soul that gives us direct access to God.
Oh, yes. you and I are due for a coffee conversation.
Yes, please.
And just her words and work and writing on attention. And there was just a deep attention that everyone had to what was going on. And I think that's what allowed us a kind of clarity as a community to respond and foster what was happening. And there were smart people in the room. There was a lot of wisdom. There was a lot of prayer. There was leadership experience that people had. So there's certainly a collaborative function that's really important there to talk about a vision and then to lock arms to strategically realize it together, which is just so exciting for me. But there was attention and there was imagination of, I think this might be what's unfolding, or this is what I'm seeing before me. And again, I think that gave clarity to our actions. And so I just wonder if they would say something along the lines of, stop and pay attention, and then let that animate your response. And the other thing I would say was, a little more practically, I would talk about the constant returning to our mission. So when we actually had to think about practical decisions, there had to be a prioritization of values, and there had to be a standard to measure those values against. And that was the mission of the school and the prioritization of our students and their experience. And yes, their spiritual development, but also why they're here, and to really give attention to that. And so having that really clear mission in mind, I think, helped us to adjudicate some really difficult decisions that arose. And how do we have all of these different alternatives? How do we prioritize among that? We prioritize it because we bring it to bear against our mission. And that brought us clarity as well. So that was very helpful. Looking back, I see the importance of constantly returning to, why do we exist? What are we doing? And I share often, and I'm sure you and certainly the listeners of this podcast are familiar with C.S. Lewis's illustration of the boat going out to sea. And this was in Mere Christianity, and the three questions it has to answer: how do I avoid sinking, and how do I avoid hitting other boats? But the third, being fundamental to the first two, why am I out here? Why do I exist? Why is this boat even on the water? And how silly it is to give attention to those first two questions without attending to the third, which is a question of foundational meaning and purpose and existence and mission. And so the more we leaned into that, the more clarity it provided to some of these other difficult things that arose during that time.
That is so insightful, so helpful, Kevin, learning from your learnings, thinking about attention and mission clarity. I'm waiting for your book to come out. So once you've had your vacation, get started on that. But more than ever, Kevin, I'm praying for wisdom to be more like Jesus each day, wisdom and clarity. Trust to take the risks he's calling us to take, and then attention and awareness to see where he's at work, so we join him in that. And what a great reminder and just confirmation of those things in leadership. This nearly hour has gone by like 5 minutes, and I so appreciate you being willing to share just from your experiences, because there's so much for us to learn on so many levels. Dr. Kevin Brown, thank you so much for being with us today. And please keep leading the way that you're leading, because I just sense this humble, attentive spirit in you, and it's inspiring. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for the opportunity. Thank you.
Well, friends, I am still processing all of that. I mean, just hearing the story from Kevin, how he led through something unprecedented in this modern age, in social media times, and also seeing how this next generation is struggling with Christianity in the church right now, but hearing what happened, I feel like the future of the church is bright when I listen to this. And then the gems that Kevin had for us on how to lead that next generation, and as leaders, how to stay attentive to the move of the Spirit so much. I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. I hope you'll share this discussion with another leader. Please leave a comment in Apple Podcasts. Consider following us or subscribing if you haven't already. And as always, stay curious and reach for the remarkable.